This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
To try and channel it.
And to see a perception of the need to dive, I think it's false.
Let me assert my firm belief.
Free and uncorrupted communication.
The Regents Lecture Program at the University of California offers us resources to bring speakers to the campus, speakers whose talents and experiences are quite distinctive and outside of or beyond the typical academic mode. This year, the Department of Religious Studies is honored to have its nominee selected as one of these speakers at UCSB. Gustav Niebuhr received his education, Gustav Niebuhr received his education at Pomona College and then later at Oxford University. He got his start in journalism, covering politics, beginning in New Orleans. But his interest in religion was never far in the background. Born into a family of ministers, theology professors, and religious educators, he grew up with an awareness of the role and importance of religion, both for individuals and for society. So in 1985, when the opportunity came along, he took his first job as a religion reporter with the Atlanta Constitution. Since then, he's been an award-winning journalist covering religious stories with the Atlanta Constitution, but also later with the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and most recently, the New York Times. He was with the New York Times from 1994 until a year ago when he became a visiting fellow at the Center for the Study of Religion at Princeton University. At the Center at Princeton, he is currently writing a book about religious pluralism in the United States. Knowing of this particular project of his, it is no coincidence that we scheduled his lecture at the same time as our own conference on religious pluralism in Southern California. Religious diversity is, of course, not new in the United States, hardly new, but the mix of faith communities is more complex and more visible today than in the past. Especially since 9/11, Americans have become more conscious of a changing religious pluralism and also conscious of religion's public presence in the lives of Americans. So it is with great pleasure that I introduce to you Gustav Niebuhr, who will speak to us on the topic, Religious Pluralism, the Continuing Challenge. Please welcome Gustav Niebuhr.
Well, good afternoon. It's a real pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this for some time, and partly because I'd never been to Santa Barbara before, even though I went to college not that far away at Pomona College. So this has been an opportunity, and it's a great one. In talking about religious pluralism, I brought along a prop, which should help me. We do live in a visual culture, don't we? So at least that's what I was always told when I was a newspaper writer, kind of a challenge, you know, to make words somehow as vivid as images. But early one morning last week, I found two vivid examples of religious pluralism waiting for me on my doorstep, wrapped in blue plastic after I got up. And they came in the form of photographs printed in the publication of my former employer, the New York Times. Now, what I thought particularly interesting about these, and I'll show you them from a distance, is that neither of these photographs was directly about our subject, religious pluralism, but instead focused on events related to the war in Iraq. In that sense, religious pluralism was somewhat incidental to the photographs, which I take as an example of how common it has become as something visual. If you subscribe to the Times, you may have seen the photographs I refer to. There is one of them. I see people nodding on the front page here. This one right on the front above the fold shows the burial of a young soldier, a war casualty, in Arlington National Cemetery. And there's six Marines bearing the flag-draped casket toward the gravesite. And they're preceded by a trio of Thai Buddhist monks in saffron robes. The young man is from a place called Waterford, Connecticut, which is a village near New London. Now, I found the other picture, which is inside, less visually striking, but possibly more interesting. On page 19, I'll describe it because I don't expect you can see it that well, but it's President Bush, fresh from having given a speech about Iraq in Dearborn, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. He's greeting a man in a black turban and beard, Imam Hassan al-Qazwini, spiritual leader of one of the nation's most important Shiite mosques, the Islamic Center of America. It's not only one of the most important, it's also one of the most ambitious, because in the last couple of years, since Imam Qazwini has been there, they have launched a $15 million building project to erect what will surely be one of the largest mosque buildings in the United States. I did see that structure last summer, sort of a shell right now. And so even though it's still unfinished, it's imposing. It stands in a very visible site above one of Dearborn's main roads, called Ford Road, because that's where the Ford Motor Company is. But the mosque's address is actually a small street that is just behind the road. The street is called Altar Road, so named because until now the only structures on it have been large Christian churches. So there's that interesting juxtaposition that religious pluralism can bring in. Well, I begin with these examples by way of getting into four general points here. And one is that religious diversity at the dawn of the 21st century is highly public. It's a visible event, if you will, visible to a degree that it was not 25 years ago, or even 10. And as such, it has to be reckoned with publicly. Secondly, the public response, especially since 9/11, has been sharply divided, with those who take a negative position on diversity getting considerably more attention, I think, a fact owing to their social prominence, a number are politically connected ministers, and to the tendency of the news media to pay closer attention to controversy than to evidence of cooperation. And yet at the same time, there's a highly important counter trend that is toward cooperation in widespread efforts made at the local level to forge ties across religious lines to strengthen the bonds of civil society in a way that accommodates religious diversity and increasing diversity. My third point is that I would say that an argument in support of those cooperative efforts can be made from American history. That is, that we as a nation have the resources in our past, if we recognize them, to support efforts to build a society that allows for and respects religious differences. We could claim diversity, we can claim diversity as an American tradition. Fourth point. But doing so at this point also requires that we recognize the very real limitations of the idea of toleration. As a word, tolerance and toleration seem to be on the lips of many people these days who seek some sort of affirmation of civic peace. But I think we ought to wonder if the value that those words represent is really what we want, especially at a time in which religious faith figures in the declarations of people who commit extreme acts of violence in different parts of the world. Now, a thoughtful student whom I met yesterday in Professor Heck's class asked me to define my terms, particularly when I was talking about pluralism. And I'm glad she did ask that. In that spirit, when I say religious pluralism, I mean a multitude of expressions of faith in which real differences are recognized and in which the differences matter among the communities of believers. Pluralism, as I use it, incorporates major traditions in the United States: Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, the Jains, and others. But it also, I would also use it to include the vital theological and historical distinctions that divide those groups within themselves. Thus, Christianity is a very broad and general label that covers a very wide range of groups, including, most interestingly now, immigrant African and Asian and Latin American churches. And to be sure, not everyone who would claim that faith identity as Christian recognizes others who claim that identity as fellow Christians in all cases. But it's always been that way here. Now, one of the main features of that make the photograph in Dearborn so interesting, I think, is that it represents one of those rare places in which President Bush has broken with a major element of his base, the politically active conservative evangelical Protestants, who are among his most enthusiastic supporters. Within 3 days of the September 11th attacks, Mr. Bush visited an important Washington, D.C. mosque and described Islam as a religion of peace, in sharp distinction from the terrorists who would claim to act in its name. And since then, when he's been asked, Ari Fleischer, Mr. Bush's press secretary, has continued to affirm and reaffirm that statement. Now, on the one hand, you can certainly commend the president for setting an example on how Americans should regard a faith with which few have any familiarity. But at the same time, Mr. Bush is also reaching out to a community that largely supported him in the 2000 election. That year, at least four national organizations with a largely immigrant Muslim constituency formed a political action committee as an expression to represent their potential political power. They endorsed Mr. Bush, and some of their members worked hard on his behalf in several states, major states, including, significantly, Florida. But after the election, the organizations had little contact with the administration, as can happen with a constituent group, and particularly a smaller one. Finally, a White House meeting was scheduled for the afternoon of September 11th, 2001. Of course, it didn't occur. September 11th really marked a turning point, too, in American consciousness about the country's religious pluralism, in particular, its Islamic minority. And part of the response was a scattered, violent backlash against Muslims in the United States. However, there was also something much more productive at work, too, instances of a much more positive outreach, and I'll talk about that later. Another response, which really didn't seem to kick in for several months afterwards, until 2002, has been a series of harsh verbal attacks on Islam itself by prominent conservative evangelicals in the southern states. The Reverend Franklin Graham, to cite one notable example, called Islam an evil faith and accused the Quran of teaching violence. As Billy Graham's eldest son, he has begun his preaching career with a built-in level of visibility, to which he's added considerably by accepting invitations to offer prayers at the 2000 Republican National Convention, at Mr. Bush's inauguration, and most recently on Good Friday at the Pentagon. Mr. Graham's attack on Islam, which was one of several made by politically conservative evangelicals last year, coincided with a somewhat more subtle statement from the Texas Republican Party, which was not noticed nationally. That's Mr. Bush's home organization, in June of 2002, the organization adopted a party platform that described the United States as a Christian nation, albeit one in which non-Christians are free to worship as they choose. And I should say parenthetically that in Texas, from what I've been able to see, non-Christians do worship as they choose. I've seen it with my own eyes, so it does happen. And just by way of anecdote, a couple of years ago, I walked into a Hilton hotel in downtown Houston to find that it was hosting the 7th World Zoroastrian Congress. It represented the first time that the Congress had ever been held outside of Iran or India. The reason that it was being held in southeastern Texas was that there's a sizable Zoroastrian immigration into that area that's occurred in the last couple of decades. And those people have done well. They're educated and ambitious and have built a significant Zoroastrian temple in Texas, southeastern Texas. So, a logical place to hold your Congress. What I see here in these expressions about Islam's illegitimacy and America's idealized Christian identity, they form one side of a debate that really is as old as the modern era, but a debate that really is reemerging now as the degree of our religious pluralism becomes more visible. In the generation after Columbus landed in the New World and began the process of bringing European Christians into contact with a whole range of new peoples, an ethnographer named Johann Boehmus wrote that the diversity of worshiping is the seminary of dissension. And he called diversity an invention of the devil. Now compare that with a statement made in 2002, about half a millennium later, in which a former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, speaking at the denomination's annual meeting, said religious pluralism lay at the heart of many of America's problems. Well, if that's true, then America's problems are part of America's essential identity, I would say. They've always been with us, and they won't go away. From nearly the time that Europeans and Africans set foot on our eastern coast and also our western coast, we've been a religiously plural people. To be sure, the way in which we've defined pluralism itself has changed over time. But pluralism has never been difficult for its enemies to recognize and condemn. The remarkable charter that was adopted in the colony of Rhode Island in 1661 said Rhode Island would hold forth a lively experiment that a most flourishing civil state may stand and best be maintained with full liberty of religious concernments. But the Dutch, who were just down the coast in New Amsterdam, called Rhode Island a sewer, and to which they would regularly dispatch visiting Quakers who wound up on the streets of Manhattan as quickly as possible. The little colony of Rhode Island also earned the scorn of Cotton Mather, who was writing from Boston. He described Rhode Island's inhabitants as a general muster of opinionists, saying, "I believe there never was such a variety of religions together on such a small spot of ground as have been in that colony. Antinomians, Familists, Anabaptists, Anti-Sabbatarians, Arminians, Socinians, Quakers, Ranters, everything in the world but Roman Catholics and real Christians." "Though of the latter, I hope there have been more than of the former among them." What would Mather have thought about Southern California? Yet what Rhode Island's governors and Mather agreed upon was not just that diversity of religion existed, but that the differences, and here are the differences between expressions of Protestantism, really mattered. By sharp contrast, the Texas Republican platform casts a nostalgic glow over this era and all subsequent eras, describing the United States as a Christian nation. By doing so, could they possibly have meant to imply that some general agreement existed between the various denominations and sects here? Now, James Madison faced this question in the mid-1780s, before the idea of freedom of conscience prevailed in Virginia. During the debate over whether the Commonwealth of Virginia should adopt a bill that would provide public funds for teachers of Christianity, a bill supported by the governor, Patrick Henry, Madison took a series of notes to himself preparing his arguments against the bill. Who, he wondered, would define the bounds of the Christian faith? The question would inevitably come before the courts sooner or later. What clue, he asked, is to guide the judge through this labyrinth when the question comes before them whether any particular society is a Christian society? Well, it was a sensible question to ask then, and it seemed prescient, too, in light of what happened in the generation after the Revolution, when the new United States proved to be extremely fertile ground for extraordinary spiritual activity. We've been a great place for religious innovators and for people who've received various revelations. Even as a culture of evangelical Protestantism began to spread across the country in the early 19th century, so there were new groups with very distinctive theologies arising, among them the Universalists, the Shakers, and the Unitarians, all of whom were going to stretch the bounds of Christianity. And I should mention as an aside, one smaller but fascinating group that I ran across not long ago called the Public Universal Friends, who were led by a woman just like the Shakers were. Sort of, there's an early, if you go back to the revolutionary and immediate post-revolutionary era, you can find early examples of feminist leadership within new American religions. The Public Universal Friends, they started on the East Coast and eventually moved to the New York frontier, where an enormous amount of religious activity occurred in the early 19th century, and the proliferation of churches and the sharp competition among them could be deeply disturbing, especially if you were a sensitive young man seeking a spiritual home. Joseph Smith Jr. would recount later how as a 14-year-old he went to a quiet grove to seek divine guidance about which church to join. His prayer was answered by way of a vivid revelation in which two divine personages, God the Father and Jesus, appeared to him saying he should avoid all the churches. They told me, he said, that all religious denominations were believing in incorrect doctrines and that none of them was acknowledged of God as his church and kingdom, and I was expressly commanded to go not after them. On April 6, 1830, Smith organized what he then called the Church of Christ, and it would describe itself as nothing less than a restoration of original Christianity. You know, I may be wrong, but I'm not at all sure that's what the Texas Republicans had in mind when they were talking about a Christian nation. New York's religious diversity also confounded Alexis de Tocqueville, who traveled across the state a year later. It's incredible to see the infinite number of subdivisions into which the sects in America have split, he wrote. Like Mather long ago, he found some that he firmly believed fell outside Christianity's bounds. The Unitarians, he wrote, were Christian in name only. Now, these days, a diversity similar to what Smith and Tocqueville experienced is exceptionally easy to find. And it exists, for example, in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, but as the inner circle of an outward rippling pluralism that can be seen as facts on the ground. If you take the big Presbyterian church that faces the town square as your center point, you find escalating degrees of pluralism as you move further out from it. Sharing the main street, which is called Nassau Street, with the Presbyterians, you encounter Methodists, Lutherans, Roman Catholics, and Reformed Jews. You go a bit further afield and you'll see the Unitarian Universalists, the Quakers, Orthodox Christians, Mormons, Christian Scientists, and Orthodox Jews. A few miles further out, you encounter the Baha'is, various Buddhist study groups, the distinctive dome and minaret of the Islamic Center of Central Jersey, and newest of all, an impressive pastel-colored Hindu temple named for the goddess Durga. And if you look a little bit more closely, you also find evidence of new Christian immigrant groups, Tanzanian Lutherans and Argentinian Pentecostals, sharing space with established Protestant churches. Again, what's important overall is the visibility of this diversity. And here I'm not just speaking about buildings. If you ride, as I do, on New Jersey transit trains between Trenton and New York, you really undertake an excursion into the individual expression of this pluralism, which is distinguished by people wearing turbans and headscarves, skullcaps, and necklaces with various types of Christian crosses. In none of this is Princeton at all unique. A similarly varied sacred landscape continues to emerge all around the United States, including in the cities of the Bible Belt, like Houston. Millions of dollars are being spent to erect new mosques and temples, often in neighborhoods long occupied by churches and synagogues. Well, that's where zoning allows it. And of course, it can create some striking juxtapositions. Last July, I spent a week in Salt Lake City interviewing a number of people in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints about the church's attitude toward pluralism, religious pluralism, and interfaith cooperation. Salt Lake, whose population is at least 50% non-Mormon, is coming to grips with a heterogeneity that can stun outsiders who assume that the city is entirely a province of the church. There's a brand new mosque within 5 miles of Temple Square and a $1 million plus Hare Krishna temple not far from Brigham Young University. One of the church officials with whom I spoke told me about going out as a guest to the dedication of a new Hindu temple a few miles to the south. It's a structure going up within the very same neighborhood as one of the Mormons' historic suburban temples. They can see each other now. In Salt Lake, as elsewhere, each of these structures represents hundreds, even thousands of people who do not cluster in ghettos, but increasingly live in suburbs. There are neighbors, co-workers, and perhaps even through marriage, our family members. So the question is, how do we get along? If one accepts the idea that the United States has always, in one way or another, been pluralistic, then can one argue that pluralism itself is the natural safeguard of civil peace? That is, does diversity create peace? Well, interestingly, Voltaire, who is not exactly a friend of religion, suggested at one point that it might be so. If a nation had a single religion, he wrote, the result would be a miserable despotism. If there were two faiths, they would fight each other to the death. But if that country were home to 30 religions, it would be blessed, he wrote, and they would live in peace and happiness. So Voltaire was proposing a system in which competing groups, each lacking a majority, acted as a check on each other's ambitions and pretensions, which sounds a bit like Madison in some ways. So it's an effective toleration through necessity. In the United States, we might be said to be putting this idea to the test. And more importantly, we're doing so at a time in which Americans, as citizens of the world's last superpower, or hyperpower, to use the term of art, have never been so influential. What we do now, we do for all to see as residents of a nation that so often is self-consciously described as a city on a hill. And by the way, the time I heard that, the most recent time I heard the U.S. described that way came from a Sudanese-born Muslim who heads a mosque in Northern Virginia and was holding up the United States as this ideal beacon. We still need to be the city on the hill. So it's interesting how some of these ideas of American uniqueness are incorporated into the immigrant experience. Anyway, that's to say that our actions are not magnified simply through our military actions, but get around in other ways, through internet communication, satellite television, as well as the reports by immigrants who remain in touch with their native communities. The world really is watching us. What would we like the world to see? Well, I think it would help us, especially among those nations where religion is still taken very seriously, and there are many of them, to know that the American people value faith itself, a distinction that makes us really quite unusual among Western nations. For decades, annual polls taken by Gallup, Pew, and others have shown that 19 out of 20 Americans claim to believe in God or a higher power. A majority claim religion is important in their lives, and 4 in 10 say they attend religious services regularly. The proportion of people who answer those questions affirmatively is far smaller in Canada and most of Western Europe. Polls also show that a large majority of our population claims to be Christian in one form or another, at least 75%. It's the other quarter, which is terribly diverse these days. But even with this large majority, and even in post-9/11 America, there appears to be a real willingness, at least superficially, to accept minority faiths. Last year, Public Broadcasting System's Religion and Ethics Newsweekly program, together with the magazine U.S. News and World Report, collaborated in financing a national poll on religious subjects. One of the questions they asked that I thought was particularly interesting was whether people thought having many different religions in the United States made it more difficult to keep the nation united. By a 2-to-1 margin, the respondents to that survey said no, it did not make it harder to keep the nation more united. But, and there's always a but, you have to be cautious about reading too much into findings like this. And the same poll indicated a very deep, and perhaps unsurprising, ignorance existing among many people about what non-Christians actually believe. Now, despite the fact that Jews have lived in the United States, and before that the American colonies, since the mid-17th century, fully half of those surveyed said they really didn't know anything at all about Judaism. It went downhill from there. 2/3 of respondents said they knew little, if anything, about Islam. You know, this is 6 months after 9/11. 3 in 4 said they didn't know anything about Buddhism. And 80% said that they were ignorant about Hinduism. Well, naturally, ignorance provides a fertile ground in which suspicion and hostility can grow. And therein lies a real danger, quite obviously. And here you have to consider the impact that public statements hostile to minority faiths can have. Last year, in the wake of the harsh comments about Islam by Reverends Jerry Vines and Franklin Graham and Pat Robertson, a communications scholar at Calvin College said such declarations could be decisive for many Americans in how they regard Muslims, given their lack of information about what Islam actually teaches. And I should add that it isn't just competing religious figures who've pushed an open hostility toward Islam. There is, quite literally, a market for that kind of talk, as demonstrated earlier this year when the Washington Post reported that merchants at a big political convention in Washington were selling bumper stickers bearing the word Islam, but with the letter S replaced by a swastika. There have been other problematic elements to this too. High-profile activities by federal agencies might reinforce the suspicion that Islam itself is foreign and hostile. Back in February, after all, the FBI let it be known that it had instructed its agents to count the mosques in their regions. I'm sure that will be useful for sociologists of religion at some point if they get access to the federal files. Because it's a great question. How many mosques are there in America? So this sort of thing does challenge the idea of toleration through necessity, that idea that Voltaire seemed to elaborate. And against this, I think, raises a more realistic but a more demanding proposal. And this is something that was articulated a few years back by the Swiss theologian Hans Küng, that there really wouldn't be peace in the world unless there was peace among religions, and there couldn't be peace among religions unless there was dialogue among religions. It's interesting that that sort of the recognition behind that statement is something that's been picked up in one way or another at the local level in the United States. And at the grassroots now, you can find many examples, not merely of coexistence, but of engagement and collaboration. Many of these efforts are new, and they either shortly preceded or closely followed 9/11. Earlier this week, I happened to be in Syracuse, New York, where I met a woman who had joined an entirely grassroots volunteer women's organization dedicated to fostering interreligious friendships. It's now several hundred strong, but it had begun when a Catholic woman and a Muslim woman sat down in their homes shortly after 9/11, and had talked about creating some sort of dialogue, and the idea had just spread through the community without any sort of hierarchy and it's spread by word of mouth. They now meet once a month. And the focus tends to be on discussion of life cycle events, the sort of thing that people can easily get access to understanding among each other, and that's really going to make a difference in understanding each other's faith traditions. I have a suspicion, but it's only that women are really central to this process in the United States now. I hear somebody say yes. Last year, I met a Roman Catholic nun who hosted a monthly interfaith discussion group in suburban Seattle. Typically, 20 people attended, Christians, Jews, and Muslims. How long had the group been meeting, I asked. Well, we started in August 2001, she said. And so, just before 9/11 and certainly surviving after it. I sat in on one of the group's meetings, which was held in a retreat house with a sweeping view over Lake Washington. And those attending appeared to be evenly divided among the three faiths. One of the Muslims was a vice president with Microsoft. Another ran a small Islamic school. A Jewish participant headed the local chapter of the American Jewish Committee. And the nun served as an interfaith liaison for the Seattle Archdiocese. There were also two or three Protestant ministers. Before each meeting, they chose a particular religious topic and asked someone to present his or her faith's perspective on it. The day I attended, they were talking about what was the human relationship with God. So, you know, they did tackle the big issues. A rabbi made the presentation saying that Jewish tradition allows one to challenge God. He was talking about Jacob's wrestling with the angel and Abraham's pleading with God on behalf of Sodom and Gomorrah. The idea, however, that humans could take issue with God proved quite provocative, particularly to the Muslim members there. And so there was this very engaged dialogue that went on for an hour and a half as people were trying to come to grips with this and explain different positions within their faith traditions. How does it work to challenge the divine? Well, the value in the discussion lay less, I think, in the theological exchange than in the simple fact that the meeting happened and it remained civil. And the gathering was intimate enough such that at one point, three Muslim participants arose, went to another room, and said their evening prayers. No one really felt like they needed an explanation. They'd already dealt with that. And after it all broke up, everyone sat around just chatting and nibbling on cookies. One man told me that these gatherings worked because everyone talked about religion. They stayed away from politics. Maybe that's the formula. Now, I found it fascinating, but I don't mean to glorify that small event. Still, I think it has important elements. People felt sufficiently trusting of one another to talk about differences, and they also sought common ground. Now, there's no question that the experience of September 11th heightened awareness of religious pluralism in the United States. And this split along two responses. Yes, in the immediate wake of the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, there were incidents of backlash, violent backlash, against Arab Americans who are not all Muslims and against Muslims. Vandals attacked Muslim property and harassed individuals, occasionally to the point of violence. Marauders broke mosque windows with gunshots at night and left anonymous threats on phone answering machines. We knew about this because it was well reported by the news media. But news organizations largely failed by not reporting the story's fascinating other side. And here I, as a reporter, accept some of the blame. It fell to a Muslim advocacy organization, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, to report eventually in the daily email newsletter that it sends out to journalists some of the kindnesses being done to Muslims by non-Muslims in the wake of 9/11. The council had been hearing from its various supporters who had stories they wanted to share. And the stories in general were quite individual. You know, reports of Muslim Americans being reassured or encouraged by non-Muslim neighbors or co-workers, even strangers. Last year, when I reported a couple of freelance articles about Islam in America, I encountered some of these stories myself. I heard about church groups that stood watch at night outside Seattle's Islamic elementary school, about neighbors who had chased off a would-be arsonist who attacked a mosque on the city's north side. In Herndon, Virginia, I saw the banner of friendship that Jewish children had made for the local mosque after vandals tore down the mosque's sign right after 9/11. Now, why did these events happen? And there were many of them, large and small. I suspect the motives were several, including a concern stemming from both secular and religious motivations, that people should not be victimized, that this is not the American way. It violates fair play, but also that it violates people's religious beliefs, the religious beliefs of those who would respond to this. And at least in some cases, I suspect that sense of solidarity arose from a real engagement that had already existed between groups across faith lines. Let me give you an example here. And it's local to me because I know the people involved. On the morning of September 11th, an Episcopal Church rector in central New Jersey got the news of the attacks on the World Trade Center, where incidentally some people in his congregation worked. He was just about to begin a morning Bible study with some congregants, and also being part of a local crisis network, he got a call from the school superintendent saying he needed to come at once with other community leaders to discuss some kind of a civic response to the disaster. When he got to the crisis center, the priest ran into the city's chief of police. On the spot, he asked the police to send a couple of cruisers up to the local mosque to prevent it from being threatened. He told me the story and sort of left it at that. When I asked him, well, wait a minute, why was this important to you? Surely you had other things on your mind on that day. Why did your thoughts go out to an entirely different religious group? He said, well, he was afraid of a backlash. And he had also taken time over the years to get to know the Muslims and had become friendly with the imam in the mosque, who was an immigrant from Lebanon. There was a face on the mosque, he said. There was my friend Hamad. It wasn't just this foreign building that you pass on Route 1. The fact that it's personal makes a difference. I visited that mosque later on because it was the scene of a citywide commemoration of the 9/11 attacks. The mayor, the city council, the police chief, there was a color guard, a military color guard, all present, as well as the community's religious leaders, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and Hindu. At one point, the Jewish cantor got everyone in the mosque singing a song in Hebrew, which was an interesting experience to see. A vision of the kingdom, some might say. At the evening's end, that Episcopal priest, whom I just quoted, announced that small groups were being formed for local men and women who wanted to meet in homes across faith lines and talk about religious commonalities and differences. Afterward, I reflected upon the fact that the people who would seek this kind of dialogue, and beyond it, acts of cooperation, might find inspiring precedent here in the United States, in our own heritage. Just as we can claim pluralism is part of our character, so we can claim that a certain level of cooperation may also be organic to the United States. People who examine the history of interfaith work tend to trace its roots to an extraordinary event on American soil, the World's Parliament of Religions, which was held in Chicago in 1893, was organized by Protestant Christians interested in proving the superiority of Protestantism. But it brought together a very diverse group of people representing 10 major world religions. The event, incidentally, began on an earlier September 11th, 1893, and it was on that day that Swami Vivekananda, a representative of Hinduism from India, gave an extraordinary speech calling for an end to religious fanaticism and persecution of all kind that would make him, thanks to the press, a national celebrity, who toured the country twice and established the Vedanta centers, which exist, of course, to this day. In our time, we can regard interfaith cooperation as helping Americans achieve one of the greatest reforms in our nation's history, finally ensuring political rights for African Americans. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is a fascinating figure when viewed from this perspective. An outspoken admirer of Gandhi, he drew to the movement Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Unitarians, and others. They marched in Selma and many other places, and at times their presence made itself felt in almost humorous ways, like the time that 16 rabbis in white shirts, dress pants, and neckties jumped into a public swimming pool in St. Augustine, Florida, for a public swim-in on behalf of integration. The civil rights movement reached its high water mark in 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And I think we ought to look back on that year, 65, as being pivotal in American history, and not just for that law. It was then, too, in 65, that Congress decided to revise our immigration statutes, providing the legal basis for what would become a new demographic and religious diversification of the American population. New arrivals, many of them with advanced degrees and professional training, have come from Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Eastern Europe, vastly increasing the number of Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Sikhs, and Jains in the United States, and also immigrant Christians of many different types. 1965 was also the year that the Second Vatican Council came to a close with a resounding bang in the form of the document Nostra Aetate, please excuse my Latin, which laid the basis for 4 decades of highly important interfaith dialogue and cooperation by Roman Catholics with other groups, which has been tremendously inspiring to others across faith lines. 2 weeks after the adoption of that declaration, the Jewish philosopher Abraham Joshua Heschel delivered a speech at Union Theological Seminary in New York, whose words about human responsibility amidst religious pluralism seem all the more pertinent now. He spoke, by the way, the day after the great East Coast blackout, when the power failed throughout the Northeast and plunged New York City, among other places, into complete darkness without lights for hours on end. The big news was that people didn't panic, and the city and society didn't fall apart. The people of New York have never experienced such fellowship, such a sense of being one, as they did last night in the midst of darkness, Heschel said. Now, I find that a very, very appealing statement because of the, well, more than metaphorical darkness in recent times. If one lived in or visited New York in the weeks after 9/11, you know that a dark cloud hovered over Lower Manhattan, and it over the ruins of the World Trade Center and floated over the city and also over New Jersey. It was like, essentially, it was the cloud over an immense crematorium. And it was in the shadow of that darkness that an extraordinary event happened, that different people of different faiths came together for a sort of a celebration of religious solidarity at Yankee Stadium on the 20th of September 2001. A really extraordinary show that some people felt extremely elevated by, and at least one person wound up being accused of being a heretic for having participated. That's the other side of this pluralism. Heschel went on to say, "The religions of the world are no more self-sufficient, no more independent, no more isolated than individuals or nations. Energies, experiences, and ideas that come to life outside the boundaries of a particular religion or all religions tend to challenge and affect every religion. No religion is an island. We are all involved with one another." Heschel's idea of involvement, which I've been calling engagement, seems to me to demand more than tolerance, the favorite buzzword. People commonly speak these days of a need for tolerance, for teaching tolerance, etc. And if that works against stereotyping, against assumptions based on rumor and misinformation, then it's to the good. But it is a low bar to clear, and its definition grows more blurred with each use of the word. For example, in the aftermath of Senator Rick Santorum's comments likening homosexuality with all manner of social ills, the White House issued a supportive statement calling him tolerant. Okay. Webster's dictionary definition of toleration is allowing, enduring, or accepting that which is not actually approved. A secondary definition is forbearance. And I can't help but think that that definition underlies the statement from Texas about the United States being a Christian nation, but one perhaps that forbears other religions to practice. In that case, toleration has an antique feeling about it, I think, something that was tried out on an official level 200 years ago in other places than this, but then soundly rejected by the founding generation of this country. In his book, The Rights of Man, Thomas Paine wrote, and here he's speaking about official toleration, "Toleration is not the opposite of intolerance, but the counterfeit of it. Both are despotisms. The one assumes to itself the right of withholding liberty of conscience. and the other of granting it. Well, as I say, Paine was speaking about an official policy. But I wonder if there's a lesson there for now, that toleration exists really as sort of a middle way, that the challenge of pluralism, especially now, when, as I say, the world seems so caught up in reacting to violence with a religious undercurrent, is that pluralistic societies demand something more than mere toleration. You can call it respect, dialogue, engagement, collaboration, or even learning, comparative religions. But it's a deeper thing, and it means that we need to hold us together in a difficult time. And that's the challenge right now, I think, of religious pluralism. Thank you.
Well, I have two simple questions for you.
Oh, good.
Maybe not. I work as on a local faith initiative for Santa Barbara County, an interfaith group. And I'm interested in what you think are some very good examples of constructive interfaith engagement that you have seen in different parts of the country. What have been some of the elements, the best practices of that? So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And then the other question has to do with social justice and social action. It seems like there is a tradition of the most sustainable basis for being a community activist and being involved in different kinds of basic issues of justice has been coming out of a faith tradition very powerfully. We are trying to work in an interfaith situation. Do we lose some of the power that it seems like some groups have by staying within the lens of a particular faith tradition to motivate and fuel their engagement, their civic engagement? Or are you seeing examples that come together in an interfaith way that isn't what somebody's called pablum?
Or lowest common denominator.
Yeah,
I think that happens across the country. I think that at its best, when people start with collaborative efforts, hey, let's do this. Let's open a homeless shelter. Let's aid these people. That may be a first step. Hey, we can all agree on this. Sort of in a secular sense or a sense of goodwill. But it's also an opportunity to start conversations. Why are you doing this? I mean, what impels you? And that may develop on a sort of a parallel track, a parallel sort of intellectual slash spiritual track in which people get to know each other while working together. And, you can be very intentional, I think, about that. Right now I'm sort of at a loss to cite specific instances of that, but I only think that's because they're so common. And sometimes they're quite spontaneous. After 9/11 in New York, there was all kinds of interfaith cooperation that developed at the scene. And people, realized that they were working across religious lines, and it endured. They respected that, and there was the grounds for conversation. Now, in terms of examples, it really, there are examples that exist at all levels. I was obliquely referring in responding to the gentleman in the last question to a very interesting work that goes on in Baltimore that brings Protestants, Catholics, and Jews together to study texts and to look at what each reads into common texts or into texts that they don't share in common. And to reflect in conversation what these texts say to them. And it's fascinating to hear a Christian perspective on Genesis 1:1 and a Jewish perspective on Genesis 1:1 because they speak in some ways to different situations. Something as simple as that. At least I've seen it that way. And so what you get is you get these you get these really sort of interesting discussions that go on in which people are sort of bringing up their own, their presuppositions and their heritage and what they always have supposed about each other, which is a very interesting thing to see. I spent a couple of days at a retreat in Maryland in early March in which you had 20 rabbis and 20 mixed priests and ministers doing this. They had three texts to study. One was, I think, from Isaiah. There was one of the post-resurrection narratives from the Gospels, and then something from Midrash. And they were all, they took their turns going through these as a group. And it was really interesting to hear the perspectives that people were bringing to this and sort of in terms of understanding each other's traditions. On the other hand, you go completely to the other side of it, and there's something in Louisville, Kentucky, called the Festival of Faiths, which occurs every November, in which a local foundation puts on a week-long series of lectures and dinners and musical performances that cut all across faith lines in Louisville, which are, and Louisville's a diverse place. It's a border city in many ways, including religiously. And, you know, it's open. All the events are free. It's wide open to the general public. People are to come. They ask any question they want, you know, eat the food, you know, see the art. There's always an art display, photographs. It's just very sort of public, hands-on. And, you know, you don't have to be any sort of an expert, but you just want to come and learn.
There's one here in Irvine.
In Irvine, too. See, I think these things go on all over the place. And then, you know, there are various groups that have formed. I think Los Angeles, indeed, has got any number of groups that do interesting things in this way.
Well, thank you, Gus, very much for a very productive.
Thank you.